Going to go ahead and call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association to order. Roll call, please.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Maria DeAnda.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jason Gordo.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Jim DeMartini. Darren Garrett.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Around, I saw him.
Joan Clendenon. Thank you, we have a quorum.
Okay, thank you. Item three, announcements.
I have several, does anybody need to go before me? I have several announcements. Okay, I have four announcements to make. One, the pensionable earnings wage base for new employees that fall under PEPRA, AB 340, AB 197. The new wage base has been calculated by the California Actuarial Advisory Panel, and they suggested essentially a 1% increase in that wage base. So next year, those folks that are integrated with Social Security, the maximum pensionable compensation for them, if they were to retire, would be $115,000. And for those not integrated with Social Security, the maximum pensionable compensation that we could use to calculate their benefit would be $138,000. Second announcement is, since we're not sure how many people we're going to have here for the admin meeting in January, we're just going to go ahead and make the decision that we're not going to have an admin meeting. We're going to combine the admin and investment meeting on January 28th.
At 1:30?
No, 2 o'clock regularly. Unless we start to see an agenda that's starting to really grow and get out of hand, but right now it'll just be the regular time on the 28th. So that leads us to, or leads me to, the third thing, that's explaining the special meeting that we're having today. It's going to be a very short meeting. Friday afternoon late, we received a disability recommendation from our disability attorney. And depending on the way that you folks vote today on that disability, it could be 2 months before this person could possibly receive a benefit. And so we wanted to make sure that this matter was resolved before the holiday, since we only are having one meeting, and we wanted to get this off the docket today. So it shouldn't take but just a couple minutes. After the regular meeting adjourns today, we're going to take a 5-minute break. We'll hand out the item on that disability case to you. You can read it for a few minutes, and then we'll go back into session. You can make a decision on it. It's actually a consent item, and we can be done with it. Very quick matter. Final thing I wanted to discuss was committees for 2014. We anticipate that there's going to be a need for three committees in 2014. Those would be, of course, the Internal Governance Committee, which always has to be in existence, the Performance Review and Compensation Committee, and the Due Diligence Committee. Currently, on the Internal Governance Committee, we have Maria, Joan, and Donna. On the Performance Review and Compensation Committee, we currently have Jim DeMartini, Darren, and Gordon. And for the Due Diligence, we currently have Jim, Jeff, and Darren. So if you are interested in serving on any of these committees, I would suggest that you put the bug in Kelly's ear afterwards. If we don't have enough volunteers, then I will work with Gordon, who is going to be our next chair for 2014, and we'll essentially set the committees the way we see fit. So if you do want to sit on one of these, let Kelly know and we'll get you on there. That's all I have.
Okay, any other announcements? All right, seeing none, moving on to public comment. Not see anyone here from the public, so I will waive reading that admonishment. Moving on to item five, consent items. If everyone has had a chance to review the consent items as listed, I'll entertain a motion to approve.
I move to approve the consent items.
Okay, we have a motion second. By Maria, second by Michael O'Neill. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Moving on now to item six.
Thank
SIS,
you.
SIS, Capital Market Expectation Review.
Thank you. If I may, before I get to that, we do not have a monthly performance review summary this month due to the early scheduling of the meeting on the 11th of the month before custodian statements, et cetera, have been produced. But I do have a preview for November. And once we have that finalized, we'll email that to staff who can forward that on to you ahead of the next month's meeting next year when we'll provide December monthly. As of the end of October, the Stan Sera fund was up 8.88% versus 7.84% for policy, about 100 basis points ahead. For the month of November, policy index should be about 1.11% up positive for the month. That will bring positive, that will bring policy for the 5 months or fiscal year 2014 to the end of November, up from 7.84 to 9.04. Assuming that we stay about 100 basis points ahead of policy, which we were at the end of October, that will put the fund up around 10% through the end of November for the 5 months versus 9.04. Wow. Okay. Asset allocation update. We have a short five-pager for you. On the last page where we set the new expectations, Rick was good enough to catch an error. So we have new page on that, a corrected version with hard copies in front of you. And I think staff notified also. But all we did is, starting on the second page, we updated the target portfolio asset class expectations given our capital market review was just finalized a week or two ago. As you know, we update those twice a year, every 6 months, generally beginning of May, beginning of November. This is information only. No action is necessary. Page three updates the capital market projections, bringing the December 2012 from a year ago up to December 2013. And not surprising with equity markets being so strong around the world, especially in the U.S., expectations have been brought down a bit for U.S. equities, down 40 basis points, large cap 8 to 7.6, small cap 8.3 to 7.9, international less so because they've underperformed the U.S., going from 8 to 7.8, and EM equity has stayed the same at 8.5. EM is basically flat to slightly down calendar year-to-date versus U.S. Equities up in excess of 20%. We've kept fixed income bumped up a little bit. Yields have risen a bit, now at 2.9%. Direct lending we kept the same. Real estate down 40 bips as well as infrastructure. And importantly, CPI or inflation down 10 basis points.
Can you elaborate a little bit on, because the markets was up, you expected it would down?
Well, we have a part of what we do is a reversion to the mean. So there's a long-term average for asset class returns. And if the recency has been that well above that average historically, we would expect them to revert back to the mean or to the historical average at some point in the future. So, yes, we do that.
So then if the market does poorly next year, the expected would go up?
If the market corrected in a fairly large way on the downside, we would most likely keep the expectations the same or bump them up a little bit, yes.
There's actually been an argument made lately that the market's already factored in quantity, giving up the quantity easing. And so when the Fed changes its policy, it probably will not affect the market as much as some people predicted earlier that it would. So,
yeah, you see that.
Make its normal correction because it always corrects, right?
It's hard to predict when you put Fed policy in the mix. It's clearly the markets are on edge with the Fed starting to taper, and you saw that again in the markets today. But many argue that this is a true bull market, and a lot of people are using the Fed as an excuse why it's going up. Or maybe it is part, I don't know. But the equity markets obviously have been very strong since March of 2009. And given that strength, we've started to ratchet down the expected returns going forward when we look out the next 5, 7, 10 years.
So even though that this is not an action item, there is some subtle implications behind this sheet that Paul's given to you.
Yes. And we'll go to that.
That will come up next month when we discuss the actuarial valuation.
Right.
So what you see is the difference between the December 2012 on the new policy mix and the December 2013 on the new policy mix. You see a reduction of about 14 basis points in the overall expected nominal return of the portfolio. After that, SIS assumes that inflation is going to be, it's going to drop 10 basis points from 2.4 to 2.3. So when you combine the effects of the nominal discount rate dropping by 14 basis points, but you also add into that the reduction of 10 basis points in inflation, you're actually seeing a net real return go from 4.6 to 4.56. So a drop of 4 basis points. That makes sense. So then what happens is after you come up with your real return, the actuary comes along and adds his idea of what inflation is going to be long term, and that's 3.25%. So what we end up having is a nominal discount or a nominal expected return of 7.81 under this new world after Paul's group has done his work. It was 7.85 last year. Mm-hmm. So what this means is that while there's no implication for a change in the discount rate, what it does mean is that our margin for adverse deviation has been lowered by 4 basis points. So last year when we set the discount rate at 7.75%, it was under the assumption of an expected return of 7.85. That gave you a margin for adverse deviation of about 10 basis points. Now, since the expected return is 7.81%, that margin for conservatism has been reduced a little bit. We're still above our expected discount rate of 7.75. It's just that our margin has been decreased by 4 basis points. That's generally not a reason necessarily to discuss dropping the discount rate, but I know that a lot of councils and boards that I've dealt with in the past put a lot of emphasis in what that margin for conservatism was. And at some point in time, even though the expected return may be slightly above the discount rate they're using, they still want a greater margin of return or a margin for adverse deviation in case the work Paul did doesn't turn out to be so. So anyway, some people put a lot of emphasis in this. I don't feel that this is a big issue since we're only lowering that margin by 4 basis points. But it's just something to think about next month when we discuss the discount rate and the actuarial valuation.
Yeah. 4 basis points can almost be argued as noise when you look at a model like this. But so it's very little change. Lowering the inflation rate obviously covers some of that.
Right.
And it's, again, this assumes all passive investing across the asset classes. And clearly we have some active managers in our fund, and they've collectively done quite well. The recency has been quite well, but we would hope that they would add some value over time above that rate.
We would hope, and that's something that's important to consider, but I don't think that that should come into play in determining what's your discount rate. I think you should always assume you're not going to get anything extra
right.
active investing when you set your assumptions. But he's right. I mean, we have in the past earned greater than the passive return historically.
So this would, I guess one could argue, this would support the current actuary assume rate.
But we can obviously have a much more in-depth discussion when the actuary is here in a month or so.
That's it.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Any further discussion or questions for Paul?
Why do you think the inflation rate is going to go down and stay the same? I can't understand why it's as low as it is already.
Yeah, I mean, we based the inflation rate off of two major sources. One is the COLA, what's called blue chip economists, and there's 50 of them. And one can argue individually, each one may not be all that great, but collectively, it's a pretty good predictor of inflation. The second source is we look directly at the bond market, and we look at the differential between tips and nominal U.S. government bonds along the curve. And that they're both, actually the tip market is probably even lower than 2.3 today, but based on those two sources, we come up with a 2.3. And I just read on an economic stat that the CPI, and I understand reported CPI and real CPI might be two different things, but it's now trending for the last 12 months right around 2% or 2.1, I think, and it's the lowest it's been in, you know, 15 years. So everything that we look at, economists forecast, the bond market, and reported CPI leads us to that 2.3% number.
Over what time period is that 2.3?
That's over, we're looking at over 5 years.
Okay. Because if you notice that we assume a number that's considerably higher, but we're pricing cash flows that aren't going to be paid for 50, 60 years. So we have to assume a much longer term inflation expectation, and that's why ours is generally higher than Paul's.
And if you look at the tips curve, it's really zero for the next few years, and then it kind of will spike up after 5-7 years higher. So that 2% is very low for the short to intermediate term, and then it will start spiking up intermediate to longer term.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Okay, moving on to item 7, Executive Director. 7A, discussion and action regarding recommendation for custodian bank.
Okay, first, I'm going to get Nathan Pratt on the phone for this piece, so hold on one second.
He's too big to travel now.
Oh,
no, he had a deadline for another client, so I excuse. Yes.
Hi there, this is Kathy Grove from Stansara. Is Nathan available, please? Hi, Nate. I'm going to put you on speaker. All right. Did you have something you wanted to say first? Or
Hi, Nate.
Rick?
Hi.
Okay. All right. First, I want to thank the evaluation team for all of their time and effort on this project. We had Donna Riley, Nathan Pratt from SIS, Natalie Elliott, our retirement accountant, Rick Santos, and myself. Just as a little bit of an introduction, in addition to the agenda item that you were all given, I want to kind of point out a few things. The custodial bank relationship may be the most important professional relationship Stansara has. Stansara has had the same custodial bank since inception. The Bank of New York actually acquired our previous bank, and which is why we now have the Bank of New York. The evaluation team took this project very seriously, and because this is not a lighthearted decision we're asking you to make. The custodian bank provides safekeeping for approximately $1.6 billion in assets for Stansara. This includes, but is not limited to, investment manager interfaces, accounting and data integration, risk management, analytics services, compliance monitoring, securities lending, commission recapture, proxy voting, tax reclaims, corporate action notification, and cash sweep services. The bank keeps track of pending transactions, settled transactions, holdings, failed trades, projected settlements and balances, and foreign exchange trades, just to name a few. Stansara, all of our investment managers, and our consultant has access to this information on a daily basis. So as you can see, our custodian bank talks to a lot of different people electronically and verbally on a regular basis. Six of the 37 ACT systems use the Bank of New York Mellon. 3 are currently using Northern Trust, and 10 use State Street. All of the State Street users are larger than Stan Serra. I understand most of the really big guys have State Street. I did find 6 other California retirement systems like BART and all some of the other ones that are closer to size than us that also use Northern Trust. Okay, as you know, we began this RFP process clear back in August. We received 4 responses in October. And since then, the 5-member evaluation team has met multiple times, either in person or on the phone, and put a lot of energy into it. So I'm going to briefly go over the process for you. To start, we each did an overall review of the proposals. I brought them here. If anybody else wants to read them, we have extra copies for you.
A little light reading.
Natalie, our retirement accountant, drilled down into the reporting and the financials for the banks, which we've summarized some of them for you here. Donna, with her background in bank transitions, did further review of the proposals. I carefully compared the IT systems and the reporting modules. Nathan from SIS also reviewed the entire proposal and contacted all the references personally. We drilled down both into the FX trading issue and the Lehman Brothers issues with each bank. Rick surveyed all of our investment managers and many of the other retirement systems through email and multiple phone conversations regarding all the banks, finding out we were looking for red flags. Is there a reason we should be using one bank more than the other? As we stated earlier, we're not really unhappy with the Bank of New York, so it was important that we were really careful through this process. Since it was coming clear this was coming down to fees and then the transition, Rick did an in-depth analysis of the fee structure. It is handy to have an actuary on staff. He can do all kinds of stuff with that Excel spreadsheet of his. We went back out to the banks for best and final offer at this point. Through all of this, what became clear is that at least 3 of the 4 banks could more than adequately serve the needs of Stan Serra. The evaluation decided, because of the fees proposed, to narrow its focus to Northern Trust and the Bank of New York. Like I said, we weren't necessarily unhappy with the Bank of New York, and Northern Trust was also the low bidder. Since this board has visited the Bank of New York recently, Nathan, Rick, and I conducted a conference due diligence call with the Bank of New York Mellon. Rick, Nathan, and I then quickly traveled to Chicago to meet with the representatives of Northern Trust and to view their facilities. Natalie and I then traveled up to San Joaquin County system because they actually use Northern Trust. And since we are very comfortable with the reporting that we use with Bank of New York Mellon, their workbench system, we figured better go see exactly what San Joaquin's using. So we wanted to put hands on and check out their system and see, does it really do what they said it would do in the proposals? Again, we just, other than it's a different system, it did everything our current system's doing. We then interviewed Fresno Serra extensively regarding Northern Trust and the transition from one bank to the other. Both the Fresno County and the city transitioned this last year to a new custodial bank, and they both chose Northern Trust. Northern Trust is a smaller organization than the Bank of New York. However, at no point during the process did any red flags lead us to believe that Northern Trust could not do as good a job as our current bank. Staff, I can be honest with you, staff is not necessarily looking forward to going through this transition, but we are not afraid of it and can have come to believe the organization will be stronger in knowledge once it's completed. The discussion we had with Fresno was they were actually, even though the bank itself, the incoming bank, is the project manager in this process, and they let us know what they need, and they really, all the extra work, there's a couple months worth of work done, the transition happens, and then there's several months of cleanup. Most of that's done by the new bank, and they lead the way. But the staff over at Fresno, we spoke to their administrator and their accountants and stuff, and they were surprised at how much additional legwork digging out documentation, chasing things down, just really staying on top of it. So I thought it was a really good conversation, so we don't have any illusions as to this is going to be a what this is going to be like. We expect it will actually take a full year of going until we go through the complete audit process with our auditors before we're completely done with all the bits and pieces. We did not invite the banks to come here because, one, the evaluation team was very thorough in its review. When we met with Northern Trust and conference with Bank of New York Mellon, each of them had 15 to 20 people on their team. So I didn't even think they'd fit in the conference room. And we learned from the other systems that typically the bank teams don't come in. They go through the evaluation process. If you would like to meet with the banks, we definitely would still do that for you. So the next step is, you know, to allow you to ask any questions. We have Nathan on the phone. Don O'Reilly is here. Natalie's here. All the evaluation team members are here if you have any questions. And but before we're done today, I do need you to direct staff to work with Hanson and Bridges to finalize a new five-year contract with one of the custodial banks. So even if we don't switch banks, we will actually be redoing the contract with the Bank of New York. So either way, we do need to have a recommendation to go into the contract process. Any questions?
Yeah, just kind of remind us the reason why we're looking for to change besides, say, the fee structure.
About a year or so ago, when the foreign exchange or the FX trading issue was going on, and at one point Stancer was actually part of a class action lawsuit against Bank of New York Mellon, and there was concern brought up by Trustee Lynch that perhaps we should be looking into another bank. And after looking through the records and stuff, we came to the determination that we pretty much have been with the same bank forever.
65 years in one form or another we've been with this bank.
So what would you say is the single most compelling reason to change it?
Well, can I speak for a couple minutes here?
Pardon me?
Can I speak for a couple minutes here? And I think I might be able to answer your question.
Okay.
With what I have to say. First of all, when I did my discussions with a couple of the other CEOs that have Northern Trust and with the investment managers, it became really clear to me that service and the platforms that each of these banks use is pretty much homogenous. There really is not a big enough difference for us to dwell on whether we're going to get better service from Bank of New York Mellon or better service from Northern Trust. So that allowed us to really start to whittle down into costs. First of all, the cost is a big issue. We're going to save $65,000 a year on average, and that's just the difference between Bank of New York Mellon's current proposed or their proposed structure that they've given us through this RFP and what Northern Trust has given us. The total savings, if we were to go with Northern Trust, from what we're currently paying, you're looking at about $325,000 a year annually. Just by going through the RFP process, should we choose Northern Trust, we're going to save well over $250,000 a year no matter what.
A year?
A year. So the price is, first of all, very hard to overlook. The second thing is that I started finding myself about 3 weeks ago trying to figure out ways to convince myself to stay with Bank of New York Mellon so I didn't have to go through the transition, because it is going to be a lot of work. And I started thinking, after I started thinking about it, and I realized that's not a good enough reason for us to just, you know, say we don't want to go through the transition. So I started to think about what good can come out of going through a transition. And when you really stop and think about it, there's a lot that can come out of going through a transition, even though it's going to be a lot of work. Staff is going to have to start from the ground level and learn a new platform altogether. So we're all going to be on the same page as we learn the new process. We're all going to be on the same page as we make new relationships with people. Should the board decide to go to Northern Trust, we'll all be on the same page in terms of our relationships that we develop with Northern Trust. going through the transition will force us to look at areas of the organization, the processes, and the governance issues much more closely. We're not going to have a choice. We're going to have to look at these issues as we go through the transition process. So, yes, it is a lot of work, but I truly believe that the price difference and the knowledge that this organization will gain over the next year going through this process is going to make it worth the effort that we have to go through to make this transition. That's just coming from myself. That's the way I feel about the issue. So I just wanted to get that out. And I'm sure Nate and Donna have something to add here too.
Well, for me, it was very similar. The idea of having to go through the transition, I felt like I had to be compelled by one of the other vendors to want to go through the effort to make that transition. Having been through bank and custodial changes before in my my jobs, it's a hard thing to go through. No matter how much work they take on, there is still a lot of effort that comes on. But as I went through it, and the Northern Trust was a very good submission, very substantial, and really covered every single base and question that I could possibly have. And then to come to, it was so much less expensive. I found myself thinking, well, what exactly? I mean, this is a 1 year process. It will take a full year. It's a lot of work for the staff. But from there on, you're with the new company, and it's like a sunk cost, and you don't really, you know, you move on from there. It's hard to come up with a good reason with this much savings to stay, even in light of as much work as it is on the staff.
Another 60 years?
Well, I would. Actually, you know, purchasing really prefers that you look at these contracts every 5 years.
It's only a 5-year contract.
No, but I'm saying, I'm joking, obviously, but you never know. Because it is a...
It's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
Kathy,
so,
did it ever come up with the New York current proposal versus the old proposal? Why in the world are you folks $250,000 out of round?
Yeah.
We didn't ask that particular question, but... we saw it too, and that was why it's like, wait a minute here, how can you do this now that you were trying to do it? They didn't answer that question.
I think the obvious answer is we have leverage in this process.
We didn't.
We brought the leverage to the table and we took advantage of it.
Yeah.
For Northern Trust.
No.
Do you remember why you were irritated at
it? It was the issue of the lawsuits. I think it was
the foreign exchange.
The security, SEC, and yes. The DOJ. What happened to that lawsuit?
So do you know what's going on?
It's still going on. It's not resolved.
Some of the banks have paid.
Yes.
Fine.
It's a class action on behalf of all the people that were affected by those foreign exchange trades.
So we asked Northern Trust, 15 people sitting around this table in Chicago, we point blank asked them, how was it that you were able to avoid the foreign exchange debacle and everybody else pretty much didn't? And they said it's always been their policy that they report out every day at the end of the day that they make these trades in foreign exchange. They report out to the clients the time of day they made the trade and what the price is. So there's always the ability for the client to go back and simply verify what the foreign exchange price was at that time of the day and see if they made it at that.
Just built in accountability.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Their trades are time-stamped.
So it was a very simple, answer to a really simple question.
I don't think Bank of New York deserves our business for no other reason than that. It sounds like we've done the groundwork to prove it.
I mean, either way, whether we switch banks or not, we're going to save $250,000
right.
A year. So this has been a successful process, 100%.
I'd just like to, I guess, chime in real quick. Just having gone through this process with other clients before, just the opportunity to publicly compliment the task force that was assigned to this. It was an incredibly efficient team, and I think that's what led to such value discovery in this whole process. I mean, when it came down to negotiations, it really was more just a transparent conversation, primarily leading, you know, with Rick leading that deep dive and functionally taking every proposal and filtering it through Stan Sarah's experience to where we can see where the profit centers were on each of the candidates was incredibly powerful bit of knowledge to really have a candid conversation. And then, you know, secondly, just the staff, the internal staff's willingness to kind of take this on and really offer to be a part of, a really unique opportunity for staff to be part of, saving some meaningful dollars. And these dollars aren't just saved to the bottom line at the end of the year, but it's compounded and it stays in the fund and it grows. And so, I mean, the savings, it truly is important. And lastly, just the Northern Trust, they were overt in saying that a size of Stan Sarah's dollar amount is exactly the client that they're trying to continue to build their business. And over the past 3-4 years since the crisis, they have, I believe, Rick, and you can correct me, it's been over 30 accounts that have come to them directly from BNY Mellon that fall within kind of our profile. So it's certainly consistent, and the savings are... is powerful.
Yeah, I would add a couple things. One, two of my clients, long-standing clients, San Joaquin and Oklahoma PERS, both use Northern Trust, and they're both very, very satisfied. And in my mind, they're the best in the class and the custodian.
For how long?
Longer than I've been with them. 15 years plus.
San Joaquin, at least 10 years. Because yeah. The CEO there, she doesn't remember when they made the switch, but she was before her time.
There's been a pickup in business in Northern Trust because of the SEC lending issues falling out from the financial crisis. Northern Trust was the only custodian of the major ones that made their clients whole from holding Lehman Brothers in their custodian, in the collateral pool. Whereas, as we know with BNY Mellon and the others also, they have not made their clients whole.
Sounds like they have ethics.
So they've been picking up business, I think, in that for that reason. And I am truly surprised, in a good way, that staff was able to come back to you with a huge savings from the current rate, because my impression was because of the crisis and SEC lending and FX and all this other, that the ability to negotiate down fees was harder today than it was 5-10 years ago, but clearly the result says otherwise, so that's a very good outcome, regardless of who you go with.
I think just the exchange rate issue, where the Bank of New York Mellon was cheating their clients systematically and deliberately, all their clients, and then in the course of this review for us to discover that they've also apparently been overcharging us for the last several years kind of closes the issue with me. I would support the staff recommendation.
Is that a motion?
Yeah.
I think Joan wants to speak.
We're going to do a contract with them?
Oh, yes.
For how many years?
5 years.
So they can't mess with the rate in that 5 years?
No. No. And we will use Hanson and Bridget to work with us on the contract. And because I know it's a multi-page contract, and we will make absolutely certain that we have the T's crossed and the I's dotted.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is it possible in this process, ethical, to ask whether Bank of New York would be willing to meet, to make the same offer?
No, it's a done deal. We went through the RFP process, and the RFP process,
okay,
we allowed a best and final offer,
okay,
and that's it.
I didn't know that's why.
Well, and for me, I would echo Mike. I wouldn't want to do that. We've seen some into the dusty corners of their business, and some of it's a little unethical, it appears. And, why would you want to do business with somebody who's, like Mike says, overcharged you for 3 or 4 or 5 years?
Well, without getting into a long-winded story that I could spend 20 minutes talking to you about, we gave everybody a chance to revise their estimates. We talked to them. We
sharpened your pencils.
Yep.
Actually, and I truly believe that this is as good as it's going to get based on what we went through with them.
And in order to make certain that we had, this had actually been done the first time, I actually sent them data from June 30th, 2013, for them to use to base their pricing structure on. And when we went out for best and final, basically, sharpen your pencils, let's see what we can do, I reiterated that and said, no, use these numbers. Because even though our current vendor has, you know, more up-to-date information, we needed to be able to compare apples to apples. So if the Bank of New York used different information, that wasn't going to help us with our analysis.
We didn't ask for a flat dollar estimate from them. We said, give us your fee schedule. And then what we did is we took their information, because it was very homogenous across all four banks, the way they price things. And we were able to put it into a spreadsheet based on our actual transactions over the last year. What would we have paid given their fee structure? So that was the analysis. And then we also tested the sensitivity of everybody's price schedule in terms of, is it more performance-based driven? In other words, if the markets do well, does your fee structure increase more, or is it more transaction-based given? If our traders pay more, do we pay more in fees? So we did also a sensitivity analysis as part of our overall work. So I feel we left no stone uncovered here.
I'd like to second Mike's motion, and then I have one more question. You said it's going to take about a year, but in terms of writing up the agreement and so forth, the legalities, how will that take?
I'm expecting several weeks, because as we all know, they probably have a room full of lawyers that they want to have talk to our lawyers. The gentleman at Fresno County that I talked to said he limited it to one go-round of amendments each. So they actually controlled the process, because even though the fee structure is set in the proposal, there are idiosyncrasies to the contract itself. How do we want the SEC lending thing to look exactly? And so there's a lot of bits and pieces like that that we will go through piece by piece and make sure that Stansberry's interests are protected. No, they didn't. But they didn't recently change. I reached out. Actually, no. I actually, San Joaquin County sent me their contract,
okay,
and Fresno County sent me their contracts. So we also have those two contracts, which are both with Northern Trust, to reference as we go forward in this process as well.
San Joaquin, as you said, was like 10 years ago, and they weren't using external counsel at that time, I believe. They used Schoenberg from Morrison Foster, though, as their counsel.
So they haven't renewed their contract? So they have an existing ongoing?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
They
probably do.
Right, but
I went out to both Reed Smith and Hanson Bridget and asked them if they had experts on staff who have done this, and if so, asked them for references so that I could verify that we were, you know, these people really do know what they're doing. And both of them assured me they had done them. They both sent me references and names of other systems that they had worked
through
the contract.
Does Northern Trust have their own contract?
I have not seen that yet. I'm sure they all do. And but I wanted to have as much background or ammunition on our side, so to speak. I shouldn't say that out loud. But so we would know what we're looking for. You know, other than the current contract we have, which is 10 years old, you know, I wanted something more current that we could base our analysis on when we start looking into the contract itself.
I guess that's where my question was, is, you know, yes, we have a 5-year agreement, then it's like we just review the numbers.
We could technically go back to RFP.
Because
that's another reason.
Yeah.
That's basically what several of the systems are doing. And I think that they're doing more of these RFPs because things can be compared electronically. You know, 10, 15 years ago, to do an RFP for Custodian Bank, even then, even though we had computers, they were nowhere near as seamless as they are now. And so the thought of doing a transition, and Donna knows, she did hers years ago. San Joaquin County did one years ago, and so much of it was manual. And so fortunately, everything's more electronic now. So what I notice is several systems have gone out for RFP in the last couple of years. Most have not switched.
Well, but, and that's the thing, is considering how long of a process it can be, mm-hmm. you know, to go out there 5 years, you know, on one hand, may make sense from simply a cost perspective. And if you're going to save somewhere, that's great. But again, it would have to be enough to...
Mm-hmm. Right. We aren't required in the RFP process. We are not required to go with the lowest bidder. We have, that is, it's information. So if we chose at this, if the board were to choose to stay with our current vendor, that's totally acceptable as well. It's an information process that we're looking for.
Sure. The fees, are they basis point charges on transactions, or is it
flat dollar? Yeah. There is one other thing I want to bring up, although I don't believe it should affect your decision one way or the other. If we do decide to switch, we would have to close out or pay up the Lehman deficit that's on the books at Bank of New York Mellon.
Right.
One of the things that they've allowed us to do is to not have to pay that off, that loss, and to be able to use income from future SEC lending transactions and slowly pay that off over time. That debt we projected to be about $500,000 mm-hmm. come April, and there will be an opportunity cost. And if you consider it this way, if you think that you're going to earn your assumed rate of return on your portfolio, and you have to take $450,000 or $500,000 to pay that off, it's going to translate to about $13,000 on a present value basis. The opportunity cost lost by not having that money invested in the portfolio as it exists now. So just a couple things to be aware of.
But there's a lawsuit going.
There is.
That will hopefully recall that money.
It's been going on for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other jeopardy, Rick, that you see in the transition with our present bank, kind of, if they know we're leaving?
No, I don't. We actually talked to Northern Trust and Bank of New York Mellon about the possibility of a transaction. They both assured us that they would both be on board and work with each other. Even Bank of New York Mellon said that they would.
Well, and we, and a couple of the people, I can't remember exactly who told us this at the time, but in a couple of the interviews we did with other systems that had made the changes, the outgoing bank figures you're a potential client. And somebody I talked to had just transitioned from the Bank of New York and said, no, it was fine. It's just a matter of doing business, and everything keeps moving forward.
And transactionally, there'll be a lot of reconciliation that will need to be done. In other words, making sure that the securities we had before are the securities we have after.
The other thing is they swap clients all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
they know what they're
doing.
They
do.
5 years is actually pretty short.
It is. Yeah, but I mean,
one never knows.
Bank of New York can't be a jerk to Northern Trust in this deal.
Because they're working on something else together.
The next time it's going to go the other way with smaller clients.
Right. LA County system just switched from Bank of New York to State Street. And they're actually in the process of that transition right now. It's kind of been going on all over.
Okay, so for clarification, the motion will be to accept the proposal as submitted by Northern Trust and to send it to Hanson and Bridget for legal review and then to bring it back upon completion of that legal review for final approval by this board. So if you want to make that motion, Mike.
I so move.
Okay.
The contract.
We're accepting the proposal as submitted by Northern Trust.
Oh, okay.
The board's giving authority to send it to Hanson and Bridget for legal review and analysis and to bring it back for final approval after that is completed.
My second.
Okay, so based upon that, Mike Lynch has made the motion, seconded by Maria DeAnda. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Moving on now to item 8, committee reports and recommendations for action. Standing committees, 8A1, discussion action to approve the revised Stan Sara bylaws. Maria?
The Internal Governance Committee met this afternoon and reviewed the final draft of the bylaws. There were some changes, relatively minor, but very good ones. Thank you, Joan. A couple of them were changes to the final average compensation, change wording, change revision to amendment based on Robert's rule.
And or revise.
Otherwise, we'd have to go through the whole thing line by line as a group. That's, I believe, I'm thinking 44 pages, but I can't remember which document I saw this morning. So that would take, obviously, a long time. So on section 1.1, we need to add to the index as a footnote. Make sure that our agenda items coincide, our board meeting agenda items coincide with what we have in the bylaws, or change the amend the bylaws to reflect exactly how we do business.
In the bylaws, the listing of the agenda items in order is not the same order we actually follow. It actually has like closed session as like the third item. And we do closed section last, so we're just going to reorder those in the board in the bylaws to reflect what we actually do in
the. But you give the chair the authority to change it anyway.
Absolutely.
Right, but why not start with what we normally do?
Fine.
And have that.
Yeah.
If we look at page 9 and then look at our agenda for today.
The order is out.
Yeah.
We're not doing it in the order that's suggested, but that doesn't mean we have to do it based on what's in Robert's rule. We can change that, but we just have to make sure that we spell it out in the bylaws.
Well, and your last sentence says the chair may change the order.
Exactly. But we'll try to make it a little more. It
says right here, the chair may change the order of the above.
Right. We'll try to make it a little closer to what we do, though. We brought that up, Gordon. We know.
Yeah.
And where it says executive director shall or may or will, we added or designee. Be consistent across the board and ensure that business goes on if for some reason it's not here. So that's the bylaws.
I have a couple of questions or suggestions. On page 6, 1-7, you have the...
I'm sorry, what's the item number?
Page 1-7 committees.
Article
due diligence one. Committee, which is 1-7, page 6.
Yeah.
You have the... vice chair appointing the members. At the bottom of the page, you have the chair appointing one or the other.
Oh, I see that.
Doesn't matter. It just should be one or the other.
Vice chair is the chair of this committee.
Okay. At the bottom, it says that the board chair will appoint.
The board chair does appoint the committee. So it's basically, the standing rule is the vice chair is the chair of this committee.
Okay.
And the committee is appointed by the vice chair
as chair
of the board.
Of two, and two other board members and staff appointed by the vice chair.
And that may be, actually the board chair assigns.
Well, that's the question. Is the chair or the vice chair appointed?
Can you show commencement?
No, that's right, the way it's written.
Vice chair as chair of the due diligence.
It could be both ways.
Yeah.
It's either one. It's just we should have a one way or the other.
Can we have it?
I think what it's saying is it's a responsibility of the vice chair to appoint this committee, but the board chair has the right to
appoint committee.
That's not what it's saying. It's not saying.
It says may appoint. retirement board members to any standing or ad hoc.
Which is
that is a mayor's
the election election part on.
I don't care. It's just I would think one or the other.
I don't think one negates the other one.
You can both appoint. We get a bunch of members. Okay.
That's what it looks like. Unless you go west on your points.
Five or six members. It's fine.
And they're going to staff. Aside from this person and these two people, but this chair goes, he or she can add more people to his staff. As the staff. Yes, chair appoints the staff.
Yeah.
You read it all word for word?
Oh, yes.
Line by line.
Item 2.6, correspondence. I appreciate getting updates like Paul just gave us.
2.6,
which is on page 9. But according to this, anything would have to be 2 weeks ahead if our CEO wanted to give us something, if a board member wanted to distribute something. I hope we don't have to have 2 weeks ahead.
I think we just need to clarify. I think it's implied there that it's the outside of the system. So maybe we just need to clarify that. Maybe all correspondence to retirement board from outside of the system or out. I mean,
why don't you go to 72 hours just so it complies with the Brown Act and take it 2 weeks out?
There you go.
Either one.
Does staff have any issue with that?
Mm-mm.
On page 35, 14.3b, we're strengthening or requiring ourselves a great deal more. All members must attend at least one of the following
each year. This has already been approved. You guys already approved
each year.
This a few months ago.
Each year.
Yep.
What's punishment if we don't?
It used to be that we had to go to two during...
Within the term.
Within the 3 years.
Yeah, so that if... If you were sick for a year or something happened that you couldn't attend a year.
We need a doctor's note.
So you're saying that this would be an imposition to go to one of these?
Wouldn't it be better to suggest just as in A?
Well, this is one of these within a three-year period.
No.
No, it's within each of the first year.
No, every year at least one of the following within each of their three-year
terms.
Yeah, and that's California.
So you only have to go to one.
Right.
In their first 3 years.
Yeah. Okay. More than 3 years. Yeah. Then I withdraw that one. Okay?
Okay. Done. With respect to election of board members, falls under 1.6, starting on the bottom of page 4, continuing on page 5. Our current practice is to send out the notices. Members within that voting class can return the ballots through a procedure, and the procedure is fine. They can do interdepartmental mail. They can turn it in by hand, or they can put their own postage on it and mail it to the retirement board with the envelope that is provided. I would suggest maybe a lot of systems go through the county clerk recorder, and they go through a very formalized process, and I'm not making that suggestion, but I think we ought to, in order to provide maybe greater participation of members during the election of officers, to provide for postage. So if we're going to do this, provide for postage so they can get them out in the mail and get them back, instead of this three-way process where it's interdepartmental mail, drive it down here and turn it in, or provide for your own postage. Any feedback, comments, thoughts, discussion?
Is that something that, I mean, I know that the cost would be minimal, but it would still be a cost. Is that something we should look at prior to making this particular change?
Well, I mean, if you look at how many general members are there, there's 2,000 general members times, what's the price of a stamp these days?
47.
So you're looking at $8,000, $800.
I think that there is a postage process available where we can put where we only get charged for those that actually are returned. So instead of actually paying for a stamp on each one, I think, you know, if you send out 2,000 and only 1,500 come back, you only pay for the 1,500 that actually came back.
Yeah, you get a first class permit. Right. And they track it, they scan it.
But you have to pay for it to go out too.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. We're already paying for that though.
Okay.
We lost the ability to send stuff through payroll years ago because they don't do stuff manually through payroll anymore. So we have to mail everything now.
I'm okay with covering postage.
Okay.
Yeah, that's, you want to send them into the board. I'm okay with that.
Just save $323,000 in bank fees.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of mail.
We've done a survey before, and we paid for the postage. We worked it out with the post office, and the hardest part of it was just figuring out how to do it, but we've done it before, and it's a very simple process, and we got the mail very efficiently and charged as we got it.
Works for me. So, then we, all right, let's see, that's a separate action item. So, with the changes made by the committee and the board, we're prepared to vote on. Recommend the approval of the changes.
That's your motion.
That's not my motion. Feel biased.
It's okay, you're the chair.
Thank you. Yes, I'll make the motion.
I'll second.
Okay, so there's a motion by Maria, second by Jeff Grover. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to ask for clarity, but just paraphrasing motion.
Well, this board's always clear.
So,
just why we record it. Recommend.
Yeah. Now, have we approved the
I'm clear.
We're good.
Yeah, they'll work. That was part of, by changing the language, basically it approves. We've given approval for the postage.
Okay.
I know.
Do you have any other comments, Gordon?
I think they need. All right, moving on to 8A2, discussion action to approve the compensation assessment policy.
We went through the compensation assessment policy, recommendations made by staff. Has everyone had a chance to read through it? The committee agreed with the wording and recommend support of the action. I move that we accept the recommendation.
I have a question.
Absolutely.
I'm just confused about the process. If I'm a county employee getting ready to retire, I began my retirement year with my base salary. So if there's additional compensation elements under this policy, those all get reviewed by Rick and determine whether they were done in a legitimate course of events or if it was spiky. And then
yes,
based on Rick's, but wouldn't almost anything that's done in that last year almost be a red flag? Why are you getting a base pay adjustment last year?
Why don't we have Dawn sit here and tell you what the rationalization was behind the policy? There are very clear reasons for what we proposed.
Okay, the things that we considered when we wrote this, we were thinking about the inconsistencies in special pay. So that's one of the things that we're going to be reviewing, is that we actually have payroll data that comes in with detailed records. And so we review the pay periods included in the final average salary. And any, you know, for most people, if they don't get a lot of special pays, their pay remains the same for several pay periods at a time, unless they receive a cost of living adjustment or something. So we can see those that are different, and we look and see what is causing them to be different. So then we look at, is this a typical thing for this person? Maybe now they're now receiving shift differential, but they were not receiving shift differential in the years prior to that. then we need to look further into that shift differential to see why in their last year or last three-year period that we're reviewing, why did it come up then? If it was because the department needed somebody to work that shift and this person was assigned to that, then that it would not likely be spiking because that was just part of their duties and it was assigned to them. If the person always had the opportunity to volunteer for shift differential, I mean shift pay, shifts during the shift pay periods, and they didn't until their very last year, and it was solely on their on a voluntary basis, it was not assigned to them, then that would be something that would need further review to determine whether it was done specifically to spike. Absolutely. And so we're looking at the frequency of the specific elements of pay that, you know, how often was this happening for this person? And we can look back for years and years and years. So if it looks like every third year this person was assigned to inpatient duty and you can establish this rotation and you see that that's what's happening there, then you've got that as supporting documentation that this is something that routinely happens for this person. And then, of course, we want to take a look at, was there something, did the person receive a huge pay increase during the final average salary period? If so, is that common among others within that same type of job? Was everybody in that job class given a pay increase, and is this normally how this is done for that particular job class? So
here's my issue or my difficulty. Rick's predecessor used to tell us that the average county employee when they left here had a 13-15% mark up front in their base year compensation. That's when everything was calculated out. And as a that strikes me as being a 13% raise in the last year. Mm-hmm. So my question is, are we making that percentage figure go up or down?
So let me speak to that if I can. One of the things that is natural, I think, to do when you're first given this task is to try to quantify what a pension spiking actually is. And normally you do that by setting, if the pay increases in the last year by, let's say, 10%, and that's an indication of pension spiking. So we started out down that path, but what we finally realized is when we started writing down different scenarios to where there could be pension spiking, we started to see that using some number really started making the process break down. It was just too difficult to put a number on it and say if they go over this amount that it's pension spiking. There are so many instances and cases and circumstances where somebody legitimately does get a pay increase at or near the end of one's career that we don't want to penalize them for. Second thing, we took a look at what the law actually says. And the law doesn't say if the person's salary is 10% greater in the final year, that's pension spiking. All it says is the board shall establish a procedure for assessing and determining whether an element of compensation was paid to enhance a member's retirement benefit. So let's assume that somebody does not do any of these special comp type situations their whole career, and in the last year before retirement, they do something that bumps their pay up by 6%. It doesn't matter what the percent is. The fact is that they didn't do this their entire year, and they did it the last year prior to retirement. That could be an indication that pension spiking exists. So we did not want to get ourselves locked into picking some number that would send us off and make us think that there's pension spiking here. What we tried to do is leave this as open-ended as possible and treat it on a case-by-case basis and consider all the circumstances before we actually made a decision on whether we think pension spiking exists. Another thing that we talked about and was confirmed through my discussions with other CEOs is that once you put something out there like a number or a very specified policy, guess what? People figure it out. And they start to take advantage of that, and they just keep it.
Rick, I get that. What happens when it's in my last year, and I haven't volunteered for the shift differential things the county needs to have done before, but my damn it, I'm doing it in my last year.
And you need to do it, right?
So I want to do it because I want to get more
But the department would have to pay that to somebody anyhow. I mean, so they're either going to assign it to somebody or somebody's going to volunteer.
That's the gray area.
So I'll tell you in that case, Mike, what we would do. We would look at the data and we'd say, this Lynch guy here is, we think he might be trying to spike his pay because he's only doing this in the last year.
But if the county's, needs to have the service,
The next step is that we'd go ask your employer, why did this person do this? And they say, I don't know, he volunteered for it. That's another red flag. Maybe there's something else going on here. And we would just continue to dig deeper. There's no sure way to be able to enforce this in a purely unbiased way. There's always going to be some subjectivity involved here, and there's going to be human discretion and decision that's going to have to be made here. And ultimately, there's several checks and balances here. Staff will do the first line, they'll be the first line of defense, then it'll go through me, and then it'll ultimately go through you folks. If I ultimately determine that we think pension spiking exists here, then it's ultimately going to go before you. But we have to come up with a policy, and I don't feel that we can be locked into some formulaic approach to determining whether pension spiking exists. We have to consider the individual cases and the individuals and the plan sponsor themselves.
And the policy is to review it.
Right.
That's the legal mandate, to review it. In your case, you volunteer that last year. I believe we would be hard-pressed after the fact to say, yeah, you did, and you got that extra 5%. But we're not going to pay your retirement on that.
No.
You didn't know that. I mean, maybe you did, but I mean, I just don't see a legal basis to say, hey, you know, you worked the hours.
No, I'm not saying I'm just confused about the...
Well, it should be confusing,
but
because there's no clear-cut answer here as to what pension spiking
is. You're setting up a review process.
But it sounds to me like, based on what Don said, is that if you never volunteered for a single thing in 33 years, and you decided to volunteer your last year, that would pop up and she would notice it.
And we look at it.
If it's something that is being reviewed, we give, in the policy, we say that we would give the opportunity to both the member and to the employer to comment on why this happened this year. And if there's a reason that it happened, but if the person comes right out, if you were to tell me, well, I did it because I wanted to spike my salary so I could have a higher retirement
benefit.
They're
probably not going to say that.
I've actually had people tell me that now, before the policy. But
I've
already had people tell me.
I don't think from my employees.
Well, you give me too much credit to the human race.
It's not wrong. You
did an
extra work.
And it would get a red flag at that point.
But, hey, Mike, but one of the impetuses behind this legislation was the fact that people were doing this, and they were being very egregious about doing this work in the last year prior to retirement. So the legislature wanted at least to give us some way to look at this.
Well, I mean, if Watson's percentage was correct, the 13%, whatever it was, that was pretty egregious. If the average is a 13% markup on everybody.
I think that was the cash out of the sick
and
vacation.
So
the vacation.
So that's not even allowed anyhow. And I would think that
vacation? It is up to a year.
Right. But I mean, so that 13% would just normally go away just based on the change in the law.
For the new PEPRA folks, they're no longer eligible to do that. However,
existing people
are. So that does still exist for a large group.
And do we have an obligation then to carry on to let the plan sponsors, are they aware of this? And do we have an obligation to let the plan sponsors know that we're going to be looking at spiking? So
absolutely. Absolutely. Again, this was not an easy decision and not an easy policy to come up with. Again, we wanted to make this very simple and make it a formula, but it just doesn't work. And so we have to give ourselves the ability to look at it on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, my guess is, I didn't really want to say this, but my guess is there's going to be very few that we're going to end up challenging. But we want to have this tool at our disposal and have the discretion available to us.
Because right now we have no discretion.
Nothing. Well, no, we don't, really. Yeah. Not legally.
So all this does is provide another break.
But there are rules built in.
It's a check and balance.
It's a lever that we can pull.
It is, right.
But there are restrictions already within MOUs, and that tells you how much you can cash out in a year. And based on my experience from the accumulation of sick and vacation time,
I would say maybe 5%, 10 tops, would cash out anything because they don't have it. People tend to use it as they get it. So, I mean, it's one of those things, you know, and then there's another percentage that are clueless, and I guess that's where my, not so much that I don't believe that they would do it, as so much that they absolutely don't understand it and don't know about it.
But you're talking about mine staff, not management.
Yeah, I know.
I had a manager who had no sick leave on the books after 33 years. No sick leave. I'll tell you later.
Okay.
And I asked him about it. I said, don't you understand that you can get, like, I don't know, the time, 25 or 35% or something like that? And he said, I got it all. I got it all.
I would like... I'm going to...
Are you okay with this? Or are you not okay with this?
No, I think this is fine. I mean, as a big starting point, let's see how it works.
Yeah, we could come back and revise this later on based on our experience, absolutely. But this is untested waters for us. And we really don't know. Like, I think Joan asked, somebody asked, how much staff time is this going to take from water? We don't know, but it's a start.
A little armband.
And they'll look at how other counties, other 37 Act counties, are dealing with this. And maybe make adjustments.
I make a motion that we accept a staff recommendation for the compensation assessment policy.
Okay. We have a motion by Michael O'Neill to accept the compensation assessment policy. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Second by Maria. Further discussion? I have just one on number three. Where it says whether pay increases achieved at the end of one's career are typically normal for those job classifications, I would put an and are routine and customary within those job classifications. So this goes back to, I think, what Mike Lynch is talking about. If it's, you know, routine and customary for an individual to get reassigned, or is it routine and customary for an individual to get promoted and is getting step increases, is that routine and customary within those specific job classifications? I think that clears it up a little bit and specifies for the employee and for the employers of exactly what we're looking at, and then what's available. I think it's routine and customary if someone gets promoted and they're getting 5% step increases. But, you know, if you're getting an extraordinary step increase of a 5 and a 5, that's not routine and customary amongst county service. So if that were to happen, that would be disallowed. So that way I think people have a better understanding of what's going on. So,
are you proposing something different than what we just...
No, just adding just a little additional language.
Well, then the motion in the second half.
Okay.
I'm talking about I'll amend the motion to include and as a routine customary.
Just additional language on item three, where at the end where it says job classifications and or routine and customary within those job classifications.
That's what I have.
I'm in the motion.
And I seconded.
Okay. So with that clarification, still a motion by Michael O'Neill and a second by Maria. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So moved. Okay, moving on now to item 9, closed session.
I make a motion to go into closed session.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say item 9A, discussion action regarding legal review for the inclusion of Prima Mortgage Investment Trust, and the authority for closed session is listed on the agenda. Maria makes a motion to go into closed session. Is there a second? Second by Michael O'Neill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Now in closed session.